Good afternoon, sir.
Hey, how are ya?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good. It's nice to be back in voice contact.
Yeah, I know. It's only been like 11 years or something.
Jeez. Oh
I
my
think
God.
Waking the Dead was just about to come out when I talked to you last.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's a while.
Yeah.
Man.
So you've become like the television guy after that.
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily completely by choice, more as much by default as anything else. But yeah.
Well, actually, I forgot that you did Singing Detective in there too. I went to see that at Toronto a few years ago too. I was.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Since we talked, yeah. But no. But mostly, I've been trying to get financing for my independent projects and working on some feature projects, but nothing that's come together. And so the TV's been great at sort of paying the bills and making a living. I mean, I will say I can't complain about that.
Right. Now, when you were shooting Dexter, where are you shooting that at?
It's shot in L.A.
Okay.
Mostly we're down in the Long Beach area because that's the area that most closely, I mean, for exteriors, I mean, down in the Long Beach area in San Pedro, because that most resembles Miami. In fact, Long Beach is actually really a good match for Miami in a lot of areas. And there's not, you don't see mountains a lot from there because, of course, Florida is flat as a pancake. So
Right.
a lot of areas further north, like the Santa Monica area or whatever, you just run into all sorts of nightmares seeing things that you shouldn't see. But the architecture and the skyline and everything of Long Beach is very, very close. And then they shoot a lot, every year they shoot a lot of stock footage. So they have a lot of stuff of Miami that is intercut in every episode, some of the setup shots and establishing shots. So, and they even do shots, which is very smart. They go down there with Michael and get shots of him just in all sorts of different costumes and outfits, walking into his apartment, walking down the street, so that, in almost every episode, you can sneak in one or two of those shots of real Miami. And I think that really helps, just psychologically, it helps you feel like you're in the place.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, are you still doing that, or are you just pretty much concentrating on this Christopher Nolan thing?
Well, the last while I've been concentrating on the, I didn't do Dexter this year. I hope I'll go back next year. But this summer I was writing the script for the Chris Nolan project, so I really kind of put all the TV stuff on hold. And I'm just hoping everyone will welcome me back, when I'm available again. It's always scary in TV because TV, they tend to use the same people over and over again, and all that. And there's always a fear of, oh, if I say no this year, will they ask next year? And I guess we'll be finding out over the coming months.
Right.
But I just felt like a real, I just wanted to get the first. I mean, I'm sure Chris would have said, oh, give me one day, a few weeks, and go to a TV show would be okay. But I felt like I would be too distracted. And, I'm not the world's biggest multitasker. So, I just felt like I wanted to focus on that and really focus on it. And now that that's it, now that, that's the stage where we're just working on notes, it's much easier for me to imagine doing something else. But at least there's a basic script done, so that's a that it's a whole different for me. That's a whole different ball of wax.
Right. Now, can you talk about that at all, or is it just completely under wraps?
Really, not much at all. It's
Okay.
Chris is very strong about security and about not discussing projects and not letting stuff out. So I'm very limited in what I can. I mean, basically, it's a psychological thriller with supernatural overtones is about the one descriptive phrase that's been cleared, which could mean sort of anything intentionally. And that's really about it. I mean, he's and I was, look, I respect it. I mean, anything around him, people want to dig up stuff on it, and he's had enough bad experiences. I think where misinformation got out earlier, partial information or whatever, that he just said, look, I would really rather that you not go into this with people. So even when I have meetings or whatever, I told you as much as I told anybody. And that's hopefully, I guess I could say hopefully I'll be directing it before too long. Hopefully we'll be making it. But it's a development process, and Chris is very much perfectionist, so it's the process takes its time. But yeah, I can't go into any details on it, sadly.
Right. Well, that was actually my question, if you were directing it or if you were just writing it and he was directing it. Okay, cool.
No,
that's
I'm attached as a director, and he would be producing it, and along with Emma, his wife, and Jordan Goldberg, who is, you know, been sort of part of his company for a long time.
Oh, that's terrific.
And it would be very exciting. And obviously, directing with somebody like Chris behind you, I imagine, would be a really nice way to do a studio project. In that, you know, you have a lot of heft behind you in terms of getting support from the studio. Again, I have no idea what it will be like until I'm there, but I'm looking forward to seeing what that's like.
Yeah, it'll be nice for a change, hopefully. Hopefully it'll be...
Well, I've never done a studio film, so, I mean, the whole thing will be new for me. I mean, but I think going into a studio film with a very powerful, you know, with a very powerful director as producer is a good way to go in. It'll be such a different experience for me in terms of budget, in terms of the whole process, that it kind of just seems like this just odd adventure. And I'm just trying to kind of wait and see, and whatever it's like is what it's like.
Right. Now, how did you two get hooked up? Was he familiar with your work?
As far as I can tell, I think it was Jordan. Although, I mean, again, we never had a real discussion about this, but I had the feeling that Jordan was the one who was most familiar with my work. Although I imagine that Chris was too, just in that we were kind of going around film festivals around the same time. I mean, when he had Memento and stuff, and Following was when I was doing films like Mother Night and Waking the Dead and Midnight Clear. So I have a feeling we were at some of the same festivals, and he probably was aware of me from that. We may have even met along the way. But I always got the sense that Jordan was the one who kind of championed the idea first to Chris. You know, but again, I never sort of asked. I just sort of felt weird and sort of saying, "Well, how did this happen?" So that was an instinct I had, but I guess only because I met with Jordan first. But that may not have been true at all. It may well have been Chris going, "I like this guy. Go talk to him." You know, I just don't know what the history behind that was.
Right, and you don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth either, I'm sure.
I think that's exactly it. Yes.
Right.
So.
Well, before we get into Static, to go from present day all the way back in the past, I mean, at least I'm not asking about, you know, Dress to Kill or something like that, Jaws 2 or something, but I don't know if I told you, did I tell you the story about my friend who edited my book and was so impressed by your interview that she ran out and rented Midnight Clear?
Oh, wow, no, that's very nice.
Well, yeah, she was really impressed. She's just like, this guy sounds great. This is amazing. She went out, rented that movie, and got home and was like, what the hell is Mike talking about? This is horrible. I can't believe this. She had rented Midnight Clear instead of A Midnight Clear.
Oh, that's really funny.
Yeah. She's like,
that's actually really, really funny. And I'm glad that was the case, because, yes, I would have hated to have made a movie that she felt that about.
So she went out and she rented the right movie, and she's like, okay, yeah, this is really good.
Well, I'm relieved and pleased.
Yeah. So you've got a fan in her. So she was very excited when I told her that I was going to be talking to you tonight. So, how about your films? How about Midnight Clear coming out on Blu-ray or Mother Night or any?
Well, Midnight Clear finally coming out in England, at least in 185, you know, from a new transfer and on Blu-ray. But it's been a really frustrating, that one has been just mind-bogglingly frustrating, because back in, I guess it was 2008 or 2009, you know, it came out a few years earlier, like 2002 or something, on DVD, and for that, Ethan and I recorded a commentary track, and I had been told at the time that we were going to do a new transfer. And, you know, finally, because it had only been transferred 4:3 over my objections originally. And I said, look, can't we do a letterbox transfer, at least for the Laserdisc? But all the people who were, you know, who actually were the money people said no. So there was never a letterbox transfer made when we first transferred the film in, you know, the 1993 or whatever, right after it came out. And finally, like 2001, they said, well, we're going to re-release a DVD, and we want to do a commentary track, and we want to do a new transfer. And I was like really excited. And we did the commentary track. And then next thing I heard, the film was like coming out with the same old 4:3 transfer. And I was really disappointed and really upset. And I kind of stayed on. I hounded, you know, Sony, who I guess owned the rights, and I hounded the producers. And finally in 2008, we went and did, you know, a whole new, you know, high-def transfer of the film and a 5:1 sound remix, and I thought it was really exciting. And then there became a whole question of rights about who owned what rights with it, and it just got tangled up and sat on a shelf for all the time since. But at least in Europe, they were unable to tangle things enough that this company, Second Sight, in the UK, is putting it out, I think, in March on both Blu-ray and DVD, and it'll be from the new masters, and it'll be 185, and you know, a better transfer and a 5:1 sound mix, and you know, so I'm really happy about that, that at least it will exist out there. But I'm still fighting the fight to try to get it out in America, in some form. I mean, you know, I mean, Sony's saying, well, you know, physical DVDs aren't making us a lot of money. Maybe we do a VOD. I'm like, I'm okay with that. Just I'd like to see it be available. But you know, it's so hard with these movies because, in a way, you'd think it'd be easy because they're small and there's not a lot of money you're dealing with. But the problem is, you know, for the companies involved, there's lawyers. It almost doesn't pay for them because in drafting up contracts and all that stuff, you know, there's lawyers' fees and this fees and that fees. And because these are small little indie titles, they're never going to make huge amounts of money back. So nobody's, like, rushing to get them done. And so it's just been this very slow pulling teeth process of me calling both sides and saying, please, please, please talk to each other and work something out. And, you know, hopefully now that there's going to be a UK release, maybe that will finally shake things loose and we can get a US release. But it's just bizarre to me that we did, you know, they spent the time and money to do this beautiful new transfer and a remix, and then it's just been just sitting on their shelves. So I'm optimistic there'll be a U.S. release, but I have no idea when and how that'll work. But at least I know that there's a U.K. one, you know, coming in the spring, late winter, spring.
So that was A Midnight Clear. How about Mother Night?
Well, Mother Night's been out on DVD forever. Nobody's ever talked about doing a Blu-ray of it. Again, you know, most films like that they haven't been doing Blu-rays of. You know, it's very, you know, that wasn't a film that made a lot of money. I mean, it did well critically, but it didn't make a lot of cash. I'm very happy with the transfer on it. So, I mean, I like the way the DVD looks a lot.
Good.
So at least that. You know, I'm very happy with the DVD. And it's still available on DVD, so it's not like it's out of print. I would love them to do a Blu-ray, you know. But realistically, if you look around, you know, not a lot of indie films from the 90s are going Blu-ray unless they were. I mean, some of them are, but it's very company to company. But most of the ones that are, or, you know, whatever, Bottle Rocket or whatever, things that did very well and got a lot of attention and did well at the box office. Because the physical cost just of manufacturing, you know, the discs and putting them out there and advertising has gotten difficult. Again, particularly in light of the piracy issue, you know, things don't sell nearly as many copies. So one of the things that's getting screwed is kind of smaller films are often not getting either released at all or, you know, not getting Blu-ray re-releases. You know, I hope that eventually Mother Night will be, because we did, I believe, transfer it in high def and then down-res it for the DVD release. So I think a high def transfer exists. And, you know, I've been sort of focused more on the Midnight Clear thing because that's sort of more active. But if I can ever finally get that done in America, then I think the next thing would be to call New Line and talk to them about Mother Night and say, you know, would you be open to a Blu-ray release? Would you be open to me calling the whatever the Criterions of the world or Magnolias and see if they would want it? You know, I mean, I'm happy to do the legwork because, again, I just think it's right now not a big part of a lot of companies' business models because it's just not where they're making money. It was a few years ago, but I think maybe if somebody like me were to say, look, I'll call Criterion, I'll call First Run, I'll call all these companies that put out kind of more offbeat movies and see if anybody nibbles. You know, that my hope is that they'd say, sure, if you want to do that and somebody's interested, fine. And that they'd make a deal where they wouldn't want, you know, a lot of money up front because nobody's going to do that in the current economic marketplace.
Right.
You know, so, You know, and that's been the problem with Midnight Clear, is that everybody wanted the better part of the deal. And the sad thing is, you're talking about five-figure number. You know, nobody's going to get rich. You know, nobody's. The difference to anyone is meaningless. But that's part of why they're not. It's not exciting and sexy to people to work on those things. Same thing with you know, Waking the Dead. I you know, we did definitely transfer that in high def. And I'd love to see a Blu-ray of that. I mean, it would look great, but. The problem with that film is even the ownership has gone through so many hands. You know, with Gramercy, which became USA Films, which then was bought by Universal, which so like, you know, nobody connected to that film's being made is even in, you know, anywhere near it anymore. So then that's going to Universal and saying, hey, you've got this little tiny film in your library that, again, did very well critically but didn't do much box office. Do you want to put out a Blu-ray? I don't know how much success I'd have, but it doesn't mean I won't try it at some point. You know, I mean,
right.
I'm sort of an optimistic cynic or something. You know, I'm realistic about the fact that most things aren't going to work out, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to try. You know,
right.
But I don't kid myself that it's. I'm aware it probably won't be the result I want, but it's also like, well, what's the harm in calling some video department and saying hi? And I'm the filmmaker, and you know, people are usually very nice if you call up and you're a filmmaker, and you know, and you say, you know, how could we make this happen? And often they say we can't, but at least they say it in a very nice way. And occasionally people go, you know, hey, you know what? That's a good idea. I mean, that is the thing. Is I feel like, you know, if you ask 10 times, maybe one time somebody goes, yeah, that'd be cool. Let's do that. And
right.
You know, they just weren't thinking about it because it wasn't at the top of their list.
Well, I'm sure that all of the persistence that you have in trying to get these projects off the ground is paying off with the persistence that you have in trying to get your old films, you know, re-released and still available.
Yeah, well, it's the same attitude. I mean, it's always,
right.
You know, I mean, independent film is by nature a Sisyphean world. You're always pushing a big rock up a hill and then it rolls down again. I mean, over the last 7 or 8 years when I haven't made a feature, I've been in sort of pre-production like 3 or 4 times. You know, there were all these times I was supposed to make a movie and something would fall apart at the last second, and it's heartbreaking and you know, deadening, but it happens to every director I know. And it's really, look at Alexander Payne, how long he was between, you know, between Sideways and The Descendants. I mean, you know, which I thought was a kind of remarkably terrific movie. But, you know, it's really hard. Projects fall apart. You know, you get all your financing based around an actor, and then that actor, you know, changes their mind because it's taking you 2 years to get the financing, or the company that was going to put in half the money goes out of business, you know, 10 weeks before shooting is supposed to start. Or, you know, I've had every variation on that you can have. And, you know, you can do one of two things. You can say it's not worth it and quit, or you just go on and know that sooner or later it'll fall together right.
Right, right. Well, hopefully that's the case with what's going on now for you.
Well, I hope so. And then there's the Chris Nolan thing, which is this whole other thing, which, you know, I think in the end, if Chris decides he wants to do it, and you know, I think we'll end up going and making that movie, so I feel very optimistic about that as well. You know, I mean, I think if we can get the script where he's excited and Warner Brothers is excited, I think it's, you know, it's a commercial piece. It's not. But, you know, with my own little movies, it's always going to be 2 steps forward, 1.999 steps back. And then and then that miracle happens, you know. And every film I got, every film I've made, every feature I've made in some way happened by some bizarre happenstance thing coming together. You know, I mean, it's never been a straight line, and it's always been like, okay, I didn't see that coming. So that's the thing, is you have to, it's kind of like being, it's like being a second string quarterback or something. You've always got to be ready to go, because you never know when some weird guy from Texas is going to suddenly go, hey, I like your movies, you know, I'll buy an assistant one, here's a check, and it'll be real, you know. And so and most of the time it isn't, but there's that one time where it is, where you've got to be ready to go if it happens. So, you know, I'm just trying to like hang in waiting for that little miracle.
Awesome. I've got one more question about Static before I let
sure.
you go tonight. I've always been curious about why Frank's kids were named North and South.
Oh, well, North and South Vietnam.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, because, you know, he met his wife in Vietnam. She was Vietnamese. He brought her back. And so in Frank's sort of warped... And I always thought, I mean, I thought that Frank did it with a sense of humor. You know, I mean, because he sees the world through a kind of a warped sense of humor. So basically, that it was his way of saying, you know, he was bringing, you know, he was bringing North and South together, and, you know, and kind of ending the war his, you know, that ending the war in his way. So that was, but, you know, but that, it was just something that I think cracked me and Mark. Well, I'll, as much as anything else, we just, you know, what would the kids be named? And I think it was, I think that was Mark's idea. If I remember correctly, he was the one who said to me, what if they were named North and South? And I just thought, I just started laughing and went, yeah, that A sounds like, it sounds like Frank, and it's hysterically funny, so yes. And then, you know, then we got, you know, had fun doing things like having those sweaters the kids wear at one point with the arrow pointing up and the arrow pointing down, and, you know, just, a lot of it was, a lot of the writing of the script was the fact that we both also shared, you know, a love of Monty Python and kind of absurdist humor. And we would just throw ideas around until something really made us laugh. And then, and sometimes we'd realize, yeah, that's funny, but it doesn't fit into the story we're telling. But if it did, then great. If we were cracking up and we felt, yeah, that really fits in, then that was our happiest stuff.
Well, I think it comes off perfectly. And you're right, Bob does just hit it just right. It's really strange. Over the course of the last few months as I've been doing this podcast, I just now realized last week that I have talked about so many first-time directors on this show that it's crazy. It's just like that energy of the first film, and, you know, some people say, like, oh, well, with the first one, you know, if you listen to the people around you, you tend to be more open to the people around you than thinking that you know what's going on. So I don't know if you think that holds water.
Well, I think it's true for some first-time directors. I think that's true. But I think there's often, you know, a little bit you know, because you're afraid that first-time directors will sometimes be a little bit inflexible, or, you know, try to have the film come out on film exactly the way it was in their brain, instead of realizing that part of the wonder of the magic of film is the alchemy that happens between your brain and the screen, you know, and it's never going to quite be what you thought, but that doesn't mean it's not better. And I've been around enough young directors to know that I think it's the few and the special ones that really understand that taking everybody else in and other people know what they're doing, you know, I think that's great. But I've seen a lot of young directors, even very talented young directors, missing the opportunity to get the most that they can from their artistic collaborators, their DP, their cast, whatever, because they're so busy trying to get it to be perfect in the way that they imagined it to be, instead of seeing it could be perfect a different way. I'm sure there are exceptions, but it's a common disease, I think, with young directors that, you know, they've dreamed this film so long that it's hard to let go and let it be what it is.
Right, yeah, that kind of over-directing kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's just like life. I mean, you see young people doing relationships all the time. You know, you see young people determined to turn their, you know, they're with somebody and they love them, but they just want to make them be more like this or that, you know? And I think it's often as you get older that you learn more and more. It's like, no, you have to love the other person for who they are, not for the idea of who you thought they should be. And, you know, that's something I think that often comes with time and with age. Not always. You know, some people are born wiser, but a lot of people have to learn that stuff the hard way.
Right. You know, I've got that theory about you and putting Christmas music in your films, and I noticed that even though you didn't direct this one, as I was watching it today, I was like, yep, there's the Christmas music.
All I can tell you is it's certainly not an intentional thing. I mean, I'd be a fool to say that there isn't Christmas music in a lot of the movies I've made. So it obviously is true, but it's never been a thing I've thought. I've never thought, like, oh, I want to do a lot of movies with Christmas music on it. It does, you know, it's just one of those weird things.
Luck of the draw, huh?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's. I can't explain it. I mean, you know, it's funny. It's so funny. I mean, and some people always look at directors' work and want to make these grand, sweeping things about, you know, oh, obviously you're interested in this kind of thing or that kind. And sometimes they're right, and sometimes they're catching something subconscious that the director's not even consciously aware of, but it's true. But sometimes, you know, it's just dumb luck. You know, if some of my projects, because people always tell me, oh, you make films about da-da-da-da-da. But it's like, yeah, but you know what? If that movie In Deep that I wanted to make and didn't happen to the last second got made, and this movie didn't get made, you'd be saying a whole other thing about what kind of movie they make. So a lot of it is just what material happens to actually make it in front of people that let them decide, like, what your obsessions are or what your, you know. So sometimes they're real, but sometimes it's just luck of the draw. And I got to say, the Christmas music one, unless it's buried way deep in my psyche, it's not conscious. But it's there. I mean, I can't deny it. but it wasn't anything I ever, at least consciously, planned for.
Right.
So, you know, but, you know, I would be a fool to say you're wrong. So, you know, what can I tell you? It's there, but I don't know why.
So I know you're sworn to secrecy with the Nolan thing, but set at Christmas?
I think I can safely say that Christmas is not a major part of it without
all
getting
right.
killed by Chris. I hope that wouldn't cross the line.
Yeah.
It certainly, again, it won't be intentionally. Now watch, you know, the film will open up and it'll, and by the time we shoot it, it'll be like all taking place during Christmas and, you know, but not as of this moment, Christmas does not play a significant role.
I hope Nolan's listening, taking some notes, you know.
Yeah, I'll get a phone call going, why are you talking about the film? It's like, I'm not really, like, this is a Christmas thing. Actually, people are going to get the impression that he's like some guy who screams, but he's just the obvious, actually very quiet and soft-spoken. But
this would be much better set at Christmas time.
Well, you know, you never know what is going to happen. I mean, it is funny. I mean, especially when you're going through a process like this. And again, I think I can talk. I think I can say this about Chris without getting killed. Is that, you know? I mean, he is a genius mind, and he does have. It is a very collaborative process. This isn't just me going off and just doing this thing in a vacuum. I mean, Chris has ideas. Emma, his wife, has ideas. Jordan has ideas. So it's much more of a. So I'm not always sure where things are going to end up, because he does sometimes come in with ideas where at first it's like, huh, that's really not what I was thinking, and then I'll think about it and realize, oh, that's actually pretty cool. So, you know, for all I know, he could come in and go, well, let's make it at Christmas time. I mean, you know, it's not, when it's not just you alone in a room, which has been a lot of my stuff, you know, it's this is the most collaboratively I've worked on a script really since Static. And, you know, while it's all me writing it, I mean, definitely Chris has very strong ideas and concepts and things he wants to try. And so, you know, it means that between now and when we make the film, there may be whole things that we haven't gotten to yet. Because
that's
his process. I mean, you know, he talks about, you know, very openly about how long he works on scripts for a long time and goes through many, many drafts. And, you know, that's not usually my process. My process is usually I write... What I write is very close to what I do at first, but Chris is really really wanting to say, well, wait a minute, okay, well, we have worked, but what if we did this? And you know, that's been a kind of really interesting different process for me.
Well, that's cool. It's nice that you get that different perspective still. I mean, even at this point in your career, you're still learning from the folks that you're working with, which is
awesome. Absolutely. Well, and you get to work with really great people. I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's one thing if it was somebody I didn't respect. But, you know,
right.
when it's somebody like Chris whose work I look at and I go, he's a great filmmaker, you know, then you want to kind of hear what he has to say and figure you don't want to, like, you know, dismiss ideas, because there's a really good chance he's got something really smart to say. So,
exactly.
You know, that's, you know, but that's why I've been very lucky. I've worked with people, you know, whether it's, you know, Chris or Jodie Foster. I mostly work with people that I really have real respect for. And so when they say something, you want to listen. I mean, what's painful, you know, it's happened to all of us in our careers at points, or when you're working with somebody who has authority over you and you don't think is smart or you don't think knows what they're talking about, that's a really painful situation. And those are the ones you try to avoid. But, you know, you always want your boss to be somebody that if they say something, you go, there's probably a good chance they're right. So I've been lucky, you know, I'm lucky to be able to continue in that vein with Chris.
That's terrific. Well, you know, I wish you nothing but the best. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me tonight.
My pleasure. And you know, I should start tuning into the podcast and, like, checking them out, you know, and doing all that, because I'm sure you had a lot of interesting conversations with people. So, you know.
Yeah, from what I understand, Brian actually listened to the Phantom of the Paradise podcast.
Well, that's cool. You know, I'm not a podcast guy. I've got to get into that, because there's so much interesting stuff out there, and I'm just a bit of a Luddite. I'm always behind the curve. Like, you know, like, I don't text much. I send emails. Like, I'm like, you know, my wife is always rolling her eyes. Like, just send a text. But it's like, so, and podcasts are something I just never got in the habit of. But I know there's people doing so much interesting stuff, and I know I've been part of doing some really interesting ones. So I'd like to, I'll start listening. I will check out the projection booth and start listening to some of them.
Yeah, you know, the guys who did, they interviewed you, I think it was Movie Geeks United, they did an amazing one. I mean, the ones that you were on for the De Palma were great, but the Kubrick series, I know you love Kubrick.
Yeah.
Their Kubrick series is awesome. They did just it was like 2.5 hours long talking about The Shining, and they just put that out a few weeks ago, and it was really good.
Wow. Well, you know, that's what I'm missing out on. So it's just getting in the habit. It's just going out there
right.
and seeing what's around. You know, I'm a Luddite. My wife always kids me about it. You know, I'm always 2 or 3 years behind the trend on electronics and, you know, and what people are listening to or using, or, you know, like I'm barely on Facebook. Everybody know, you know, is on Facebook all the time. I like to have an account, but I never go there, you know. And it's not some like weird snobby thing. It's more that I just get comfortable with what I'm used to, and I just sort of stick with it until finally I get beat up by enough by all my friends saying, you have to do this, and I do it, and I go, oh, this is cool. But,
right.
just, you know, I mean, maybe it's an age thing. Maybe I'm just over that line where, you know, I'm always a late adopter, not an early adopter.
The thing for me is I listen to them in the car. So that's where I do most of my podcast listening.
Yeah, which makes sense, and that's a great place to do it. You know,
because
you're driving somewhere, it's probably a hell of a lot more interesting than most of what's on the radio. And
right.
you can listen to something that you know you're interested in instead of hoping that, you know, NPR won't be talking about, you know, something you couldn't care less about or something.
Exactly.
I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and like half of my podcasts that I listen to are all NPR stuff that I wouldn't miss on the weekend. And
right.
then the other half are movie podcasts or Freakonomics or some of these other more offbeat NPR shows. So
yeah, no,
yeah.
Freakonomics is great, and I've never heard it, which is bizarre. I have NPR in my car all the time, but I've managed to never catch that show.
Right, and that's the convenience thing.
Yeah, is that yes?
Yeah.
See, there's the language. I'm still talking about catching it. It's like I could just put it on the damn iPod or iPhone, and you know, listen to the thing. But you
right.
know, I just never think of it. It's just,
yeah.
you know, but so I appreciate you bringing it up because I'm going to get off the phone and actually like download a couple of things, and that way I'm going to make myself start doing that. So.